Welcome everyone to the Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness Summit. I'm Dr. Christine Schaffner, and I'm here with my colleague and dear friend, Michael McAvoy, and we're going to be talking about helminthic therapy, autoimmunity, and evolutionary mismatch. Welcome, Michael. It's really great to see you.
Thank you for having me, Christine.
Yeah, well, I think you're in this beautiful setting for this amazing topic, and this is something that I've been continually intrigued by, and I just always trust your perspective. And I know that you research an incredible amount before you become, you know, formulate an opinion. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say today. And as the title kind of alludes to, I want to first dive into this idea of what you share as evolutionary mismatch and its relevance to chronic illness. So can you just set the stage for the conversation and share your thoughts about this?
So evolutionary mismatch is a term that was sort of first used in the 1940s by, I believe the person attributed is Ernest Mayr. And essentially evolutionary mismatch has to do with the fact that there are certain inherited genetic traits that were once advantageous in a certain type of environment, which have now become maladaptive in a new or different or changed environment. And so this concept of evolutionary mismatch is we start to look at it, start to understand that it's really central to understanding the genetic involvement with the rising tide of chronic disease in the modern world. And it also leads us to envisioning new treatments that could potentially augment and fulfill the genetic code for certain individuals that are more aligned with producing inflammation. But if those individuals had exposure to certain types of helminths or parasites, that a lock and key mechanism is almost established to the point where if they're missing a certain environmental vector, and as I want to talk about briefly, an article that I published in the Holistic Primary Care magazine that really ties this concept together, we really need to take a step back and look at how evolutionary biology has been very much relegated from the discussion of modern medicine and chronic disease. And a lot of that has to do with politics, with the fact that medicine, by its virtue of trying to identify pathogens as the sole vectors in disease, have become obsessed with that effort. And in this process, medicine still, in my opinion, does not have the maturity to investigate the concepts of inheritance and genomics through the lens of evolutionary biology. This has a lot to do with the creation of molecular biology, which is about 100 years old. And I would argue that molecular biology, which is the template that we use to study genetics today, as well as the basis of modern medicine, is more of a technology than it is a fundamental science. Molecular biology has a lot to do with neo-Darwinism and the principles of neo-Darwinists, such as survival of the fittest. The neo-Darwinists got the upper hand in the creation of molecular biology, and as a result of that, became obsessed with sort of their own personal eugenicist views of what they wanted medicine to become. But in that process, evolutionary biology has largely been relegated from the textbooks as well as from the discussions in modern disease and in modern medicine. It's very interesting because if you look at the population data and the epidemiology between the first world countries and the third world countries, we see a large disparity in the types of diseases that show up. And I specifically mean that the disparity is that in the first world nations, there is a high prevalence of inflammatory diseases. I'm talking about a high prevalence of allergy, atopy, eczema, psoriasis, autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, inflammatory bowel diseases, on and on and on, neurodegenerative diseases, inflammatory diseases like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. These diseases have been largely minimized and to a large extent absent in third world geographies. And the question has always come up as to why is that, why does that disparity actually exist? And this was the basis of the hygiene hypothesis, which later became sort of the evolutionary mismatch hypothesis, which is that certain genotypes are predisposed to producing inflammation. Why is that the case? Because our gene pool and our immune system has evolved specifically because of diverse pathogen interactions. We do not have an immune system unless we have millions of years of pathogen interaction. And those pathogen interactions are not only capable of producing inflammatory immune responses, they also create adaptive symbiosis. The concept of symbiosis was really pioneered by a wonderful biologist by the name of Lynn Margulis. And she really led the flame to showing us that organisms evolve together. And that from this research, we have to very closely redefine what pathogenesis really is. Because as we've come to learn over the past several decades now, and there's been many years of clinical trials that have been done on helminthic therapy, ingesting either orally or cutaneously, inoculating yourself with various helminths or worms or their eggs to arrest various inflammatory autoimmune diseases. Many successful clinical trials have been performed. But through that knowledge, we have gained a deeper understanding that what we call pathogens needs to be carefully redefined. Because, for example, Trichuria suis, which is a helminth, is classified by the Centers for Disease Control as a parasite. However, Trichuria suis has clearly demonstrated the ability to arrest inflammatory bowel disease in a significant percentage of patients. I'm talking about colitis and Crohn's disease. There were two randomized clinical trials conducted in 2005 that clearly showed that significant benefit. So we have to really now look at, we have to really, in my opinion, revisit and redefine pathogenesis through these new lenses, because what we are learning from the clinical trials and what we're learning from metabolomics testing that has been done on how helminths interact with our immune system, how they downregulate and dampen the Th1 autoimmune response, how they dampen and attenuate the sought after immunological pathways that are centrally discussed in these autoimmune diseases, the lock and key mechanism of helminthic therapy becomes more clear as we start to unravel this.
Wow. You know, so that's a lot to take in, because the people who are listening, right? This is focused on mycotoxins, but also the chronic illness world, right? So this is a very, and I have similar thoughts. I haven't dove as deep to you, but I do feel that, you know, our health is highly, I mean, we've evolved, right? We have a microbiome, we have a virum, we have a microbiome. Like, it's not this war against war against microbes, right? It's this, evolution, as you said. And then I how I've made sense to that, modern life has kind of insulted our terrain so much that some of these things can become opportunistic and then thrive in our body and create symptoms. And so this is like a whole nother narrative, right? That we're missing a potential parasitic infections that might not even be called parasites, because they're offering value to the patient's health because of our modern, maybe more sterile, less diverse world. So it's kind of like this, there's some similarity in these themes, because I think biodiversity, adaptation, resilience, all of these things are key to health. But we're looking at it from a whole different angle, because parasites are really common, right, in this patient population who are chronically ill. And we have this, you know, all these anti-parasitic strategies and cleansing the bowel and, you know, getting rid of things. And so do you feel like these two ideas still can interact with each other, or is there a conflict there?
So the difference between a parasite and a helminth is actually very simple. Mm-hmm. A parasite feeds off of the host. A helminth provides a mutually beneficial relationship between the host and the colonized worm. And so as we begin to look back throughout history, we realize that protists and worms have been a part of the human biome for such a long, long, long time that their absence is only, their absence has only appeared within the last couple of hundred years because of sanitation practices, the increased incidence of the increased use of antibiotics and other immunomodulatory therapies. But the key distinction is that a helminth provides a mutually beneficial relationship, whereas a parasite feeds off of the host. Yeah. So when I'm talking about helminthic therapy colonization, I'm not talking about colonizing with parasites. I'm talking about colonizing the biome with ova or worms that are not capable of moving outside of the intestinal biome, and but are at the same time capable of releasing various molecules into the host, which regulates or modulates many of the inflammatory receptors that we know are involved in various autoimmune diseases.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the distinction, the clarification. And Ken, is there ever a situation where a helminth can become parasitic because of terrain or other conditions in, you know, the gut, or is that not a possibility?
Well, that's a great question. And it comes down to individuality. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily suggesting that helminthic therapy is ideal for everybody. But I think that it's first important to ask who are the patients that would benefit the most. And we know from what's already been published that type 1 autoimmune diseases, TH1 driven autoimmune diseases, are primary candidates. We know, just speaking of SIRS for a moment, I know that this is really about your summit is very much about that. I wrote an article a couple of years ago on my website, metabolichealing.com. It's a free article that's available for anybody. And the title of that article is SIRS and Helminths, Is This the Missing Link? And I just asked the question that, you know, is it possible that SIRS, which is the chronic inflammatory response syndrome response to various either mold or mycotoxins or so-called biotoxins, can that be possibly related to a long-term multi-generational biome depletion of helminths? And as we start to peel it away, we realize that as Richie Shoemaker has done his important research uncovering that chromosome 6, the MHC2 region, which is the HLA class of genes, HLA2, is largely involved in the genetic association to SIRS. What's interesting about that is that helminths directly act to inhibit the major histocompatibility complex 2, versus MHC1 is more driven by viral pathogen selection. MHC2 has been more driven by parasite selection and parasitic peptides. There has been a flurry of studies that have shown that certain helminths can secrete cystatin protease inhibitors. We know that one of the way that fungi and mycotoxins can adversely affect the respiratory tract is by the secretion of various proteases. We know that helminths can directly interact and inhibit this process. We also know that many people that have SIRS and autoimmune disease, many people that have SIRS may have autoimmune disease also, or may have, whenever I work with clients, taking an inventory and just seeing if there's that going on or if it's in the family. And oftentimes I find that's the case. So there's clearly a link between autoimmunity and SIRS and the possible interaction between diverse pathogen exposure versus not diverse pathogen exposure. And what do I mean when I say diverse pathogen exposure? Again, when you have a biome that has diversity, a diversity of microorganisms, the diversity creates a situation where you become less susceptible to the pathogenesis of single pathogens. The less diversity of microorganisms you have, the more susceptible you are to the pathogenic effects of single pathogens. And that again has a lot to do with the fact that we have all evolved with microorganisms as symbionts. What we call pathogens is sort of a misnomer because we can live with tons of, and I've run stool tests and I'm sure you have too. And, you know, we deal with a lot of sick patients so that, you know, whenever you see a sick patient, you run a stool test, you find, you know, you could find anything wrong with them by looking at a stool test. But if you look at a healthy cohort, not too many good scientists are actually looking at controls. They're only looking at, let's just study the sick people. Let's not look at the controls. But I've actually seen many healthy people, including myself, that would show various pathogens in the stool, yet we present no symptoms. Why is that? How is it we present no symptoms whatsoever, but we have all of this colonization of all these so-called pathogenic microorganisms? They've done studies in Africa that have shown that healthy indigenous people living off of the land truly in remote regions of Africa are loaded with bacteria that are strongly associated with Crohn's disease, yet don't possess those symptoms of whatsoever. How is that? And I think that what we really need to do is to take a step back and really redefine pathogenesis as different degrees of dyssymbiosis, the ability or the inability to tolerate other microorganisms. Because immunology is very much about adaptation, the ability to adapt and to get stronger, to learn, literally, biological plasticity, to actually learn from the pathogen exposure that you had, that your immune system gets smarter. It remembers what to do. It remembers not to overact next time. That's the level that we need to get, because we can get rid of, we can try to get rid of mold from our environment. But guess what? We'll never be able to do it. It's not possible. Mold is everywhere. It's everywhere. It's always been everywhere. Why is it a problem now as opposed to 200 years ago or 50 years ago even? What has changed in the environment? What are the things that have changed that have led to a dysregulation and a dyssymbiosis to form that we now call SIRS, or we now call autoimmune disease, or we now call enter in the next disease label? We have to look at the relationships between microorganisms in each person. Because we're never gonna figure out these complex problems by using the old model of medicine, which is single pathogen vector oriented, which was good in the 1800s when you had acute illnesses caused by pneumococcus or whatever. Today, it's a different world. It's a completely different microenvironment. We have completely different biomes, which are completely depleted of helminths, virtually. Yeah. And that's been studied and proven.
Mm-hmm. No, you make an excellent point. And, you know, I think, you know, I agree with you. I think I've just been thinking about this from a different angle, you know, and I've been thinking of the increase in toxicity that we're all exposed to, and that how that is weakening our terrain and how that has been underlying. I haven't, and I, you know, of course, think about, okay, biodiversity of the gut and, you know, all of that. But I guess maybe, how do you make sense of like the rise in toxicity and the absence of helminths in the body?
That's a really good question. And I just want to say that there is no question that the environment that we're living in is very toxic. Mm-hmm. And the interaction of various chemical toxins, many of which are not even detectable, microplastics, for example, that we're consuming on a regular basis from myriad number of sources, that all of that is going to directly affect our microbiome. We do know from other research that microorganisms have the ability to sequester different toxins. Mm-hmm. I remember years ago, you know, reading papers that showed that 50% of the dry weight of a bacteria can be a heavy metal like mercury or iron. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not necessarily any different from helminths or worms or any other microorganism that we're colonizing. I think we have to start to look at these complex interactions with the environmental toxic factor as how that is affecting our biome, because it is. There's no question that it is. And the ability, and when we talk about modulating the biome, most people think, oh, more probiotics or more prebiotics. Well, that's fine. I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But we have to always remember that what we have missing in the Western world that is not missing in the third world are helminths. Mm-hmm. Just talk for a moment about that article that I published in Holistic Primary Care. And I really think that it's a segue into this to kind of illustrate the significance of this. Consider that the APOE4 type has a 20-fold risk of developing Alzheimer's dementia before the age of 65 that is specific to the first world, to the United States. If you US have the APOE4 genotype, you've got a very high risk of developing Alzheimer's dementia. If you live in Papua New Guinea, or if you live in sub-Saharan Africa, have that APOE4 genotype, or if you live in the Amazon basin, you do not develop Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is negatively correlated to those regions and is not correlated to that genotype in those regions. The reason for the disparity is Helminths. And the literature on that is very, very clear. There was a study done on Amazonian horticulturalists basically showing that the greater parasite diversity that APOE4 genotypes have, the better cognition they had with age. Not only did they not develop dementia, but their cognition actually improved with age in the presence of parasites. We know from other research that APOE4 carriers have a greater, stronger immune response. They have a more of a recoil in their ability to combat different types of pathogens. We know that because we look at the mouse studies and the human studies and the metabolone studies on APOE4. We know unequivocally that they have a very robust innate immune response. That's good for one thing, but bad for something else. And that specifically means that if that APOE4 genotype that many people out in the Western world have, whatever it is, 15% or so, that genotype didn't evolve in the United States in the first world. That genotype evolved in pathogen-rich regions of the world. And that's why those pathogen-rich regions don't have a prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. Transplant that APOE4 genotype to New York City, and you're going to have the appearance of a new disease in the gene pool, i.e. Alzheimer's disease, which for that genotype is relatively new. That is called maladaptation or maladaptive genetics. So just for that genotype alone, I proposed in this article that I wrote the need to look at helminthic therapy as a viable treatment, as a necessary treatment to attenuate the inflammatory tendencies of the APOE4 genotype. But it doesn't stop there, because as you start to really go into this, you realize that so many other genotypes that we now look at have specifically evolved because of parasites. The HFE hemochromatosis gene is another one. The LRRK2 gene that's associated with Parkinson's disease is also a result of pathogen diversity genotype. Genes that are even the RCCX cluster, genes that are copy number variations. Why did they copy? Because it was nature's way of saying, we need more of this gene to fight this kind of infection. And parasites are the modifying factor for these genotypes that are now associated with modern diseases. And what happens when you deworm the third world? There's been a plethora of huge randomized trial studies and cluster studies in the third world showing that if you have patients if you deworm patients with Helminths, they then do their evaluation to show glycemic markers, huge increase in insulin resistance when you do long-term deworming protocols. Same thing with vascular disease, inflammatory markers. So not only are Helminths a modifying factor of our genotypes, but if you remove them in certain populations by deworming them because we think we're doing the right thing, you wind up creating a new disease that didn't previously exist. Wonderful if you're big pharma, right? And mind you, the World Health Organization is very much aware of this subject because they have published articles linking to these specific studies and have funded some of these studies. So we know that these large organizations have the so-called philanthropic, we want to be doing good in the world by deworming the third world. But what happens when you do that, and the results of that are explicitly clear. So we have to really understand that what we think of as parasites as being pathogenic may be true in some people, may be true in certain cases. However, we have genes that we have clearly inherited that specifically evolved because of parasite interactions. And you remove the parasite, eventually you're going to see evolutionary mismatch in real time. And I believe that this is one of the more overlooked phenomenon in evolutionary biology and in modern medicine today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely my mind is open in a way that I haven't probably looked at this. And with all of your explanations, Michael, and, you know, I mean, we kind of think of like also endogenous retroviruses or the virome, or, you know, this, you know, we vilify, you know, pathogen, and then, you know, forget all of the, you know, the help it's, you know, doing us to evolve and, you know, actually be more helpful than harmful in the end. And so I see your point. And I guess, so walk us through helminthic therapy. Are you doing this? Have you had experience with clients and collaborating with patients? And just maybe walk us through this so we can go deeper and understand how this works.
Well, yes. So I'd like to just mention, you brought up viruses and retroviruses, and I do want to say that there have been studies that have shown that helminthic therapy has the ability to attenuate the interferon response as well as the innate immune response to viruses in particular. And this was also done, there's human and some animal studies looking at this as well. So as you were mentioning, the virome, you know, supposedly we have 380 trillion viruses or some unfathomable number in our body, in our biome, that makes up who we are. I mean, we're literally comprised of more microorganisms and viruses and bacteria than we are human cells by an enormous order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. But there is a direct, helminths definitely have an inhibitory effect on viral activity and the innate immune response to viruses, which means that they're a potential benefit for various so-called viral infections and may also be a totally overlooked treatment in that regard. Getting into treatment, I want to first give a real shout out to an organization that I think is doing tremendous work. And if you're on your browser right now, go to helminthicwiki.org, helminthic, H-E-L-M-I-N-T-H-I-C, therapywiki.org. This is an organization of a community of people that have aggregated thousands of patient testimonials from people that are self-treating using helminthic therapy. And if you go through the testimonials, you'll be astounded at what you read, as I was and as I continue to be. They've also done a good job of aggregating about close to 1,000 published studies on helminthic therapy in animals, in preclinical studies, as well as in human studies. So helminthictherapywiki.org is an absolutely phenomenal resource for people to get familiar with this concept. And also, there's a Facebook group there that of people that are sharing their own experiences doing it. Because I have to admit that a lot of my patients don't want to do helminthic therapy because it's still too much of a foreign concept. However, those that have done it have gotten benefit. And it's simply because there's a huge potential to attenuate complex signaling in the body using something very simple. The other limitation with helminthic therapy as it is today is that the cost to do it is still relatively high because of the fact that there are certain FDA regulations on the culturing and the sale and distribution of helminths in the United States. Many people that are doing this kind of therapy have to source helminths from outside of the country, from labs coming from outside of the country, which is totally feasible. But the cost of all of this can get a little bit exorbitant. But if your health is at stake, if you have multiple sclerosis, of which there's been at least 3 or 4 clinical trials in humans showing major benefit, I just want to tell a quick story on that. When I was about 15 years ago, I was contacted by a 22-year-old male who had been recently diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And he told me that he was going to enroll in some clinical trial happening in a major university in the United States using helminthic therapy. And at the time I hadn't heard of it, I wasn't familiar with it. And I said, well, good luck. I hope it works for you. 6 months later, he calls me back and he tells me that 5 of his 6 brain lesions were gone and the 6th one had shrunk by 50%.
Wow.
I said, that's pretty dramatic. So that was my first experience with helminthic therapy. And ever since then, I've been very interested in this concept. But the ability to do that is, you know, the ability for helminths to work on these levels. Again, people out there thinking, well, what kind of disease do I need to have worms? I can't wait. Get me started right now. Where do I get started? Well, I'll say this, is that we don't yet know who is not the best candidate for type 1, for helminthic therapy. Because as you go through the list of testimonials, anecdotal reports from individual self-treating, you see an enormous amount of categories here. It's not just type 1 autoimmune diseases. It's also PANDAS. It's also salicylate sensitivity. It's also neurological symptoms. But it's mostly autoimmune disease, because I believe that the genes that we've inherited that are the links to autoimmune disease are the immunological genes. And those are usually the ones that are associated with HLA2 or HLA1 or RCCX or cytokine genes, et cetera. So I would just say this, is that for inflammatory bowel disease, if you're looking for a treatment, because I would unequivocally say, give it a shot, because there is no question it could save your life. And as you read the testimonials on the helminthic therapy wiki pages, which I encourage you to do, I was just perplexed at how many people have gotten benefit. And why this therapy is not more widely used is really, really something that I want to get behind and promote. Because we need, from a scientific perspective, we need more data. We need more clinical data. We can't move forward unless we get more clinical data. And so I really encourage you to embrace, to just be open to this concept, because I think it could really save people's lives. Mm-hmm. And it already has.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important, especially as you said, like, and when, if your life is on the line, if you're having one of these really, you know, grave diagnoses that doesn't have a lot of treatment, I think when you weigh the risk benefit, it absolutely should be considered. I mean, my brain is going, and I'm sure you've gone there too, like, okay, very different, but let's say, okay, you know, how probiotics, we made a supplement out of them, right? Is there any kind of like forward thinking, like some of the anti-inflammatory agents that the helminths produce, like we can encapsulate, or peptides, or, you know, things so that we can have this, or is it like, that's too reductionistic?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad that you asked that. So obviously, when there's been thousands, probably tens of thousands of studies, preclinical studies, animal studies using helminthic therapy, metabolomic studies investigating all of the, you know, for example, one helminth that's commonly used, Trichuria swiss, is capable of secreting 250 or 300 different peptides into the host. That's 300 bioactive immunogenic immunomodulatory molecules into the host by a single colonizing helminth. Mm-hmm. So, of course, most of the funding for this research is coming from drug companies or subsidiaries of that. So they're always looking for the patent, the single thing that's the most effective protease inhibitor, and let's patent it and let's put it in a supplement or a drug, of course, is where it's going to end up. So, you know, this is going to eventually happen. Eventually it is. This is inevitable. We'll be talking in 5 years. Oh yeah. Now do you hear about this new drug that they got? Oh yeah. It's derived from this worm, ova of this worm. But I honestly think that, well, they're, what's that? Yeah.
Shout out to right.
I honestly think that nature is primed when best. And while it may certainly be beneficial to have some drug in the future that is derived from a worm, there's many nonlinear interactions between the helminth and the host that are not even studied and understood. For example, the prostaglandins that certain worms can secrete have completely different effects as our own knowledge of our own prostaglandins. We think of prostaglandins as mediating the cyclooxygenase pathways and all this, but as you start to look at research, I'm like, wait, this doesn't even seem to make sense from what I knew about prostaglandins in humans. So these worms are doing something completely different with their own prostaglandin secretion. So there's so much that we don't yet know about the complex nonlinear interactions of how worms have co-evolved with humans for millions of years. And I'm not talking about just humans, but I'm talking about all life on this planet has microorganisms that have symbiotically co-evolved with them. And that includes worms in different species. We're no exception to that. We're not separate from this earth or from the Gaian super biome that makes up all of life. We're not separate from it. And we have to realize that we've become separate from it in many ways because of iatrogenic medical treatments, because of toxins that we've been exposed to that have led to dyssymbiosis, the inability to tolerate other microorganisms. It's not getting rid of them that I'm interested in. It's how can we increase tolerogenesis? How can we increase adaptation? And how can our bodies learn from the symbiotic relationship that all organisms that inhabit us have with us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a very, you know, this is just a new tool to think about, but I have a very, that's my belief in health. You know, the bioregulatory approach or looking at, you know, regulation and resilience and adaptation. And I think, you know, there are many takeaways for people to take from this conversation today. But, you know, I think we have to give up the war, you know, give up that kind of, you know, war idea on microbes. And we have to think about also, like you said, like we can't live in these bubbles or these Faraday cages or these, you know, sterile environments, you know, if we have a mold issue or, you know, it's like, how do we create a more resilient terrain, right? So that we can walk through whatever life brings and, you know, respond, adapt and move forward. And I think this is, yeah, this is, I mean, I you know, to be very honest, in my guy, I've always, you know, because I do treat parasites and I do get results with that, but I know it's not the same, you know, but it gave me that kind of thought of like, you know, is this something to think about? Helminth therapy, or is that gonna, are we just trading one problem in for another down the road? But I mean, I hear you. I mean, we look at microorganisms all the time, and it's the balance of these microbes in our body that, you know, provide health. And I think just because helminths are a little bit more unsightly than, you know, lactobacillus or, you know, like these other, you know, microbes that are not our own, you know, our human cells, I think it's probably, you know, it just, you know, we need to be educated. So I so appreciate you educating us today.
Thank you for letting me speak on the subject. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, definitely, Michael. And you mentioned a few articles and you have a phenomenal website. I always love reading your articles and you've opened my mind up on many topics and you have a really wonderful way with words and distilling really amazing, you know, boiling down a lot of research into an article. And so I would love for people to learn again how to find you and your work and anything else you'd like to share.
My website, I have two websites. My main website is www.metabolichealing.com. That's metabolichealing.com. And my other website is true.report. That's www.true.report. That's our genomics and analyzer software. So we actually have that going on as an ongoing research project to help to have basically patients or practitioners upload their patients' genomics and or blood chemistry to get an analysis. And then the metabolic healing site is largely for practitioners. We do trainings. We have a number of different clinical training courses that created over the last 8 years and lots of free content, 13 or 14 years worth at this point. So there's three specific articles on helminthic therapy that are up there and you can look for them just by going to all articles. There's the one on APOE4, which just came out. I republished that from Host of Primary Care. Really interesting. And then there are other ones that was published a couple of years ago, and then one on evolutionary mismatches, which was published just last summer.
Well, thank you, Michael, for being on the summit, and thank you for your passion for diving so deep into these topics and educating us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you.